Welcome to the Conestoga Podcast. This is Program 19 for November 23rd, 2006. Conestoga is Oklahoma's largest literary, science fiction, and fantasy convention. I'm Chris Murley, your podcast host, and it's time for another podcast recorded at Conestoga 10. This time, it's back to the wonderful world of fandom, and who better to talk to than Keith Stokes. He was our fan guest of honor at Conestoga 3. He's the newsmaster for the Science Fiction Writers of America, treasurer of First Fandom, president of the Dawn Patrol, and helped found the Science Fiction and Fantasy Hall of Fame, not to mention a great photographer whose pictures at conventions are too numerous to count. One of the subjects we talked about in our conversation was about writer and fan Wilson Bob Tucker, who passed away on October 6, 2006, so this podcast is dedicated to his memory. It was recorded at Conestoga 10 on July 30, 2006. And now for my conversation with Keith. Welcome to the Conestoga Podcast. This is Chris Merrill, your podcast host, and today I have Keith Stokes, who has been a former fan guest of honor at Conestoga, and he's going to tell us why it was a bittersweet event for him, but I want to welcome him today.
Thank you, Chris.
And why is it important to our listeners that we honor our fans?
Well, unlike a lot of the genres, the fans have been very much a part of what science fiction literature has become. From the very beginning, the fans were involved with feedback. Fandom began out of letter columns in the very early science fiction magazines. There was a chance for people to write in and ask questions or comment on the stories. And when they happened, they actually included the address of the fans coming in, and they started contacting each other. That feedback very much had a lot of impact on the literature, and the early fans became many of the early authors.
Of course, kind of jumping around a bit, we've appreciated the work that you've helped us do because you used to do our website for Conestoga. Of course, I took it over from you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
of course, Bob is probably, Keith, I'm sorry, I have Bob's on the brain. Keith can often be found at conventions with a camera and taking lots and lots of pictures. And if you go to, was it midamericon.org?
Yes.
You can find a wealth of pictures documenting the going-ons at conventions,
authors, fans. About 6,000.
Only 6,000. Okay. That's quite a few. You could probably make a movie out of that. And being a longtime fan now, I know there's another organization. It's called First Fandom, but I understand you're a little young to be in that organization. How does one who wasn't around back in the 30s, or at least old enough to be a fan, become associated with First Fandom?
Well, fandom was originally started around 1950, and part of the reason for doing fandom was to get some of the earlier members of science fiction fandom involved again. There had been people that had been involved more or less at the inception, and they gaffiated, which they refer to someone getting away from it all and dropping out. And at that time, there were what they thought were a lot of fans. There was probably several hundred across the country, which seemed like a lot to them. And they established rules at that time that to participate in that particular group, First Fandom, that you had to been involved in science fiction on some level, either collecting or writing to the letter columns or participating in a club-type event prior to the first World Science Fiction Convention. Over time, they expanded that some, and they added other categories of membership. There is a category of membership which requires simply that you have been doing one of those same types of activities for at least 30 years, which I have. I've been collecting for certainly quite a bit longer than that. Because many of the people that were the very first ones, the ones we call the dinosaurs, are getting to the point that they no longer have as much interest in doing the work of the organization. Mm-hmm. They actually don't have any distinction between the different categories. Someone in my category, from the standpoint of doing things within the organization, has the same status. I can vote on things the same way. And actually, a good friend of mine Joan Marie Knappenberger from St. Louis, when she took over as president of the organization, and she's a little bit younger than I, had asked me to get involved with the organization, and I came in and within a fairly short period of time was treasurer of the organization, as I am now. It doesn't require a great deal. We don't have big finances, and we're not doing a lot of different activities. Probably the two most visible things that we do is a quarterly newsletter, and also that we present awards each year, typically just at the very beginning of the Hugo Awards ceremony. There's two or three categories that we might recognize, including the first Fandom Hall of Fame. And actually, at several Worldcons, I've had the opportunity to help present those awards, which was an honor and certainly a little bit intimidating, wearing the tux and getting up in front of 2,000 or 3,000 people to do that.
Yeah, in any setting, that can be intimidating. One thing, I did go take a look at the First Fandom website, and if I recall correctly, there was a name that jumped out at me. He's never been a guest at Conestoga, but he was a regular feature of previous OCONs, and I distinctly remember him from those days, and that's Wilson Bob Tucker.
Yes.
And you know, you also had to stand up in front of some audiences at WorldCon for him as well. What can you tell me about, I believe he was awarded a Retro Hugo, is that not correct?
He's received two Retro Hugo Awards. Which are presented... they can be presented for Worldcons in which they had not originally done the Hugo Awards.
Mm-hmm.
It has to be done on an anniversary, the 50th, 75th, or 100th anniversary of that convention.
Wow.
And at two different times when they've been presenting them, Bob has been nominated. He actually was nominated in two categories, in one of those categories, each of the two times. And again, I got to wear the tux, get as much use out of that tux as I can, and got to accept for that. The first time, actually, Joan Marie Knappenberger and I accepted together, and I remember how nervous we were at the time, and we got up there, and she held it and kind of bounced up and down while I rather shakily thanked everyone. But it's a real treat. I can also tell you it's a lot of fun after the award ceremony going around to all the parties carrying the Hugo Award. It gets a lot of attention, particularly from women. They all come up to you when you're carrying the Hugo Award, and I need whatever help I can get.
So do you have any favorite stories about Bob that you'd like to tell?
Well, Bob is a wonderful storyteller, and let me explain for anyone that might be listening to this that isn't familiar with who Bob is. Bob was one of the very first people active in science fiction fandom. He started writing to the letter columns. He started publishing a fanzine, which is kind of a personal magazine that'd be distributed to the other fans. When one of the very first years, I think it was year Worldcon 3, I could be wrong on that, the group wanted to host that in Chicago. They came down from Chicago to Bloomington, Illinois, where he lived, to get him because they needed someone old enough to sign the contracts. And so he had a very crucial role in that Worldcon. Over time, his fan writing, which became very popular, expanded into professional writing. He published probably somewhere around 15 to 20 novels, about half of them in science fiction, the other half in mystery or action adventure. He also, along the way, became a wonderful speaker. And conventions along the line started making a point of having him at the conventions. He, along with Forrest Ackerman, are probably the two best known of the early science fiction fans. And I've been blessed to have a chance to spend a fair amount of time with both of those people, much more with Bob. And he's been wonderful to me on a lot of levels. I've been very honored by the chances I've had. And we've had a chance a couple of times to turn that around. In recent years, Bob has been unable to travel. He gets nauseous if he tries to travel any distance at all. And so although he was still very much loving everything, he just couldn't go to it. Thanks to the Internet, he was able to stay involved. But we decided to bring the mountain to Mohammed a couple of times, and the first time was something we called the Tucker Tribute. And that was done in Bloomington, Illinois. We brought about 100 people from around the country that loved and respected Bob, that wanted a chance to to see him again and participate. We honored both Bob and his now late wife, Fern Tucker, that mm-hmm. weekend, and really had a lot of fun. Among other things, the mayor of Bloomington made that day Wilson Bob and Fern Tucker Day.
Wow.
Had needed to speak at the program, and I'm not particularly a great speaker. Fortunately, Roger Tiener was doing the weekend with me, and he is very mm-hmm. much a speaker. But I needed something to do, and so I decided to make it easy for myself, and I contacted many of the people that have known Bob for a long time and had them email their comments or their blessings for the weekend. And so we interspersed all the other program items with me reading two or three of those at a time. It became a real treat for me. Someplace along the line, quickly decided that I wouldn't give the names of who wrote them until I got to the bottom.
Okay.
And you could see people kind of guessing, and you could see when the light bulb would go on, those people that had figured out who a given was or whatever. And I built some over the night until I got to the last two. And the next to the last one actually was from me. Chance mm-hmm. for me to say what he'd meant to me. And the last one I had, as I was reading it, you could see about half of the people in the room that really were science fiction fans, and maybe not so much some that were family of Bob's and things like that. When the person mentioned he'd probably never leave Sri Lanka again, everyone knew that it was Arthur C. Clarke, which was pretty cool.
Well, that's fantastic. Yeah, I have fond memories of Bob attending some of the early OCONs.
Mm-hmm. So. Well, Bob, you would see often sitting to the side of one of the rooms. At that time, he would be smoking a cigar.
Didn't he always have something else in his hand, too?
Yes, he'd have a green bottle of Beam's Choice whiskey. Really not the world's best whiskey. A lot of people want to go back in time and have him start doing his tradition with something different. But one of the many things in fandom that Bob's known for was a little ceremony called a smooth. Mm-hmm. And that was performed with passing around that bottle of Beam's Choice.
And how did that smooth go?
Well, as often as possible, you'd have someone doing the smooth that had never been and seen one before. They were called a virgin.
Uh-huh.
And Bob would bring that person, or maybe several at a given time, in front of him, and he'd get their names. And the bottle of whiskey would be passed around all of the people there. And you didn't have to take a drink. Mm-hmm. You could just sniff the bottle and pass it along. Mm-hmm. And then you'd hold up your right hand.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, the entire group would do that. In fact, I can remember a SoonerCon where we were doing it out in the hallway.
Mm-hmm.
And these people came through that were just staying in the hotel that weren't part of it. And they saw it, and they stood back very respectfully and silently as they could see that something very spiritual was happening. But at the very end, Bob would again say the names of the people that mm-hmm. were the very first-timers and say that as virgins, they had been very smooth and sweep his hand from right to left and bringing it down. I have a very short video of a bunch of his family doing that at the weekend that we did to honor him. Bob was responsible for a lot of our traditions.
Mm-hmm.
The practice of including the name of real people in roles in science fiction stories.
Mm-hmm.
He was the one that started doing that, and it is known as Tuckerism for him.
Okay.
And if someone like Larry Niven does it, he refers to it as it being a Tuckerism. Bob coined the phrase space opera.
He did.
Which
he might have enjoyed a night at the space opera last night.
Exactly. And actually, if it does not yet, the next edition of the Oxford English Dictionary will include him in the etymology of that phrase.
Well, that's excellent. Yeah, I think I'm going to have to use that in my Battle of the Toastmasters, that question,
mm-hmm.
Who invented the term space opera?
Well, I guarantee that Robin Bailey will – actually, I'm pretty sure that all of them will, but actually – wanted to get the exact time that it happened. A couple places wanted to do it to document it, and among others, I'd passed it along to the people that were getting information mm-hmm. for the OED. And Robin has a complete bound set of La Zombie, which was Bob's best-known fanzine,
mm-hmm.
and I had to go back and go through all of Robin's zombies to get the exact date that that was done, which I believe, I forget the month, but I believe that was 1939. And so it'll be a real problem if he doesn't get that one right.
Yeah. Well, as much as we love talking about Bob, I think we should focus on you a little bit again. Now, when you were fan guest of honor at Conestoga, mm-hmm. we have a lot of the same people that worked on that convention, and I was an attendee, so that was my first introduction to fandom. For you, that was a bittersweet honor, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. For a great many years, I had a American Eskimo dog named Charlie. And for those of you that don't know what American Eskimo is, it kind of looks like a Samoyed, only quite a bit smaller, white, very alert looking with the upright ears. And I think he was a very intelligent dog. He traveled with me a lot. He flew two or three times along the way. And he was along with me when I went to convention just because he was with me. That actually, whether or not I could, a hotel allowed pets would be one of the reasons I might go there. And someplace along the line, actually I think it was Brad Denton to mm-hmm. tie it into to this convention, had asked me to bring him along to a party at the convention one night. And Charlie was such a hit that all of a sudden he became a fixture out in the conventions.
Mm-hmm.
The conventions actually would make a point of wanting to have him there. You'd occasionally see his bio in a program book. A couple of times a convention in Wichita actually negotiated with a hotel that didn't permit pets to allow Charlie to stay in the hotel. The first year this convention was held, it was at a different hotel, which had a no pets policy, and I had faxed a polite letter to the management of the hotel asking that my dog come with me, and so he was allowed to attend and go around to functions in the convention, while our poor chairman of the convention had to sneak her dog in to participate in the play that year. So he was very well known, and he and I were asked to be fan guests of honor at the convention.
Mm-hmm.
Sadly for me, after a little over 14 years, he passed away just a few months before the convention, and so he was not here with me.
There was something else I was going to ask. You are you're also a webmaster, and you still do quite a few websites, don't you? What are some of the websites that you maintain?
Well, currently I don't carry the load that I did at one time. I do the website for the bid for the World Science Fiction Convention mm-hmm. in Kansas City. I do the website for First Fandom. I do a website for a fan group called the Dawn Patrol.
Mm-hmm.
Give me a second to think of which other ones I do. The ones that I'm probably best known for is I do a portion of the website for Science Fiction and Fantasy Writers of America.
Mm-hmm.
I handle the news section of that site and done that for about 8 years. The other one is the photo archive, which you've mm-hmm. alluded to already. And I house that at the Worldcon site, midamericon.org. Mm-hmm. And that fan photo archive is photos from, actually I haven't counted up how many different conventions, but as I said, there's about 6,000 photos from conventions, some of them going back from before I was in fandom, as other people occasionally contribute.
Well, people can go to the website and look at all the pictures and see, you know, and if they think they might be one of the pictures, they can look for their own.
Yes, the index that I keep on it is mm-hmm. only current through early last fall, but it's set up to do a Google search on someone's name, so that's probably the quickest way to find all the instances of their picture possibly showing up there. Also, a lot of people have found it if they just go to search on Google Images on their name. Mm-hmm. There's a real good chance that they'll suddenly see any number of photos mm-hmm. of themselves at that site.
Hopefully not in compromising positions.
I try not to do anything that'd be questionable without asking. I do occasionally ask someone if a given photo is all right. I've only had two times that someone has asked that a photo be taken down, which mm-hmm. which I've done immediately.
Okay. Let's see. What else do we have here? Oh, and when I was reviewing your bio before your interview here, you were involved with the Science Fiction Hall of Fame when it was still in Lawrence, Kansas.
Yes.
Now, how did you get involved in that? And the process of moving it from Kansas to Seattle, was that also a bittersweet transition?
It certainly was. I got involved because I was co-chair of the convention we have in Kansas City conquest at the time that Robin Wayne Bailey, your Toastmaster at this convention, had the inspiration to have such a Hall of Fame. He wanted an opportunity to give some of the people that are no longer perhaps recognized in the field by new readers, people that have read 10 or 15 years, have read hundreds of science fiction works, and have no idea who these people that really are the reason we have what's there and still have a lot to contribute. He came to us as chairs to see if we would be willing to do a charity auction to raise money for such an organization to get it started. That idea was well received. There needed to be people to get involved in figuring, well, how will you do this? How will it be organized? And this resonated with me, as I care a lot about the roots of our field. And I ended up doing a lot of the organizational work and lucked out. I was real surprised at the time that I was elected to a position on the board. And actually, I ended up for the first few years being the chairman of the board of directors. At the last 2 or 3 years of the board, Robin Wayne Bailey took over that position. And he was chair at the time that the Hall of Fame moved to Seattle. Yes, it is bittersweet. I think it was probably a good move that we had taken the Science Fiction and Fantasy Hall of Fame as far as it was going to go. It could have stayed at the same level, but it would never have the visibility and the impact that we might hope it would be. Moving it to Seattle and making it part of the Science Fiction Museum did change some of the emphasis. Fantasy dropped out. They do not honor any new fantasy writers. They have to be a science fiction writer or artist or other professional to be recognized. And although others might disagree, I see them both very much as part of the same genre and important that way.
A lot of the authors go back and forth. As a matter of fact, David Drake writes both science fiction and fantasy. And I know that Fritz Leiber wrote both as well. And he was a little more better known for his fantasy, but he also wrote science fiction too. So,
well, and the line isn't always that clear. In fact, there's things that we would not agree the same whether which one they'd be in. And there's authors that consider their work one or the other that I wouldn't necessarily agree with. Anne McCaffrey comes to mind, who's very popular, of The White Dragon and that whole series of Pern books. I think of as fantasy, but she feels as science fiction, for example.
I think some people might consider some of Roger Zelazny's stuff to be, I'm still not sure whether it's science fiction or fantasy when I reread them, even though they're just fantastic stories.
Well, and a lot of the authors, and I've heard several mention, Bob Tucker's mentioned it to me, Hal Clement had mentioned that, for example, if you have a story with time travel in it, it's fantasy, much as it may have all the trappings that you'd think of it as being science fiction.
Well, I know I kind of tend to use the term sci-fi, like as in Star Trek or Babylon 5, because that's, you know, they have more fantasy elements in them, although they look like they have the trappings of science fiction, but they're not really. They are more fantasy.
Yes, or space opera.
Yes, space opera.
But I kind of like speculative fiction for SF.
I don't know. I agree with some people that it's kind of a dry term. It doesn't conjure up anything for me. Of course, Hugo Gernsback invented the term science fiction, and then it eventually came science fiction. And yes, it's hard to define, and it is a bit of a misnomer, but for me, it's an adequate title for it. But I understand why people use speculative fiction. It is a little more, I would say, technically more accurate. But I'll still call it SF. So,
well, I think we're all pretty comfortable with that. Sci-fi, of course, some people are not happy with that phrase. And Forey Ackerman, who I mentioned earlier, was the person that coined that phrase.
Well, I was reading up on that the other day, and I discovered that actually he popularized the term, but maybe Wikipedia is wrong, but they were saying
that's
that,
easy to
yes, I know, but they were saying the first citations of it were some letters that Robert Heinlein wrote that predated Forey Ackerman. I'd always read that Forey Ackerman had coined the term.
He says he did too.
Okay,
which.
But anyway, the first sightings of it. But I've always make a distinction because I say television and movies, that's sci-fi, and then the literature, the printed material, is science fiction. Mm-hmm. And so I don't have a problem distinguishing between the two. I know some people use it as a derogatory term, but
And some people really resent it. In particular, Harlan Ellison very much resents the term and holds that very much against Forey Ackerman.
Well, Harlan is going to be Harlan. and he's a fantastic writer. Is there anything in particular that you would like to address or you'd like to talk about?
Well, the first thing comes to mind, it would certainly be just to thank you and Mel and the wonderful people here mm-hmm. at Conestoga. It's been a wonderful convention mm-hmm. every year. And also has treated me extremely well. I can't to mm-hmm. say how much I appreciate that.
Well, I think I just remembered what I was going to ask you. Mm-hmm. Yesterday, I was interviewing Margene Baum, and we were talking about Worldcon. Oh. Now, I have my own selfish reasons for wanting Worldcon in Kansas City in 2009. I won't have to drive as far. Now, I went to my first Worldcon last year in Glasgow, so flew quite a distance for that, and I had an amazing time. Melissa and I had an amazing time while we were there. And, of course, it was very sad to learn that Kansas City lost the bid for 2006. Anyway, so how much are you involved in helping with that bid for 2009?
Well, I stay a little bit at the fringes. When the Kansas City first bid for 2006 mm-hmm. and was a very close competition, although we lost that particular bid to L.A., when that first bid was being put together, actually at the Tucker Tribute some years back, after most of the weekend was over, a group of people filed into the room I was at and actually kind of formed up in a circle around me. It looked a little bit like an intervention. they told me that they decided that they were going to bid to host the Worldcon. And actually, they'd asked me if I'd be willing to be chairman, which I basically held my fingers up in the form of cross. And that was a much bigger project and something actually I couldn't afford to do. Among the reasons, actually the last year, you pretty much have to take a year off of work even to be able to
do the job. It is definitely a huge, huge, massive undertaking.
So I have purposely kept just a little distance mm-hmm. since that time. However, I would like to see it happen, and these are people that I do like very much and respect, and I've been involved for both that bid and the current bid in doing all the web work, actually paying for all the expenses of mm-hmm. the website to try to give them a fairly visible presence, and certainly the internet is one of the least expensive ways mm-hmm. to be promoting whatever activity mm-hmm. has, and actually by this point, maybe not so much the first time around, it's necessary. If you don't have a certain mm-hmm. level of web presence, you have no credibility.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm kind of wondering if maybe this is maybe it's not going to be funny, but it is amusing to me. And I think a way to help promote Kansas City is, of course, all I can think of is that one song out of Oklahoma, "Everything is Looking Up in Kansas City."
Or Up to Date.
Up to Date in Kansas City. They have a skyscraper, was it 7 stories tall? Mm-hmm. So I don't know if that could be your theme song, but
The local NPR station has a weekly program called mm-hmm. Up to Date, mm-hmm. but... of course, actually one of the things I really respect about Kansas City is I've only been living there for a little over 20 years, is you very rarely hear the song, "I'm Going to Kansas City," mm-hmm. which is a decent song, but when you have a song like that about a community, it'd be very easy to wear that out.
Mm-hmm. I can see that. I've always enjoyed when I've gone up there. I was in the area, and I happened to see where the convention center was going to be in Overland Park, mm-hmm. and it looked like an excellent facility. There's a lot of hotels very close together, so I think it's going to be an excellent site location for a Worldcon, and I wish you guys the best of luck and hope you do win it. And if you have any more sales pitches, you know, that you say, hey, this is why people should come to Kansas City, why you should vote for it, feel free to.
Well, I think it's a group of people that know how to, not just how to put on a convention, but how to show people a good time. It's a group of people that have worked very hard over the last few years to participate in the other Worldcons, to work on them in various levels, to develop some of the skills that will be necessary to be able to put on a good convention. At the same time, they've made the contacts that are probably even more important. With the possible exception of some communities like Boston or L.A., there is no place that has a big enough experienced fan base to do all the jobs. And even in the cases of Worldcons in those big cities, a majority of the positions on the Worldcon are actually performed by people outside in other parts of the country. People doing an amazing amount of volunteer work and expense maybe traveling all through the preparation, multiple trips across the country to help prepare even to put the convention on, and then just work their tail off through the weekend and never get themselves to really experience what goes on. So from that standpoint, they've done the groundwork. They do have a nice facility in a community that wants to have the convention. They did something very, I thought, very unusual. For example, in Toronto, when it got down to the final voting for the decision between L.A. and Kansas City, and they needed to come and do the dog and pony show, make the presentations. Mm-hmm. Not just members of the Convention and Visitors Bureau came from Kansas City to promote it. The mayor of Overland Park came to promote that.
Wow.
And supposedly had a wonderful time there at the Worldcon. So that's a commitment that'll mean a lot. Kansas City does have a lot of nice things to do away from the convention, but most people don't go to Worldcon for that. They want that too, but they're going for the convention itself.
They want that option.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, as I said, wish you the best of luck, and hopefully that you know if I can anything that I can do to put my two cents in, say hey, go to Kansas City. You know.
Well, certainly make sure that you have a membership, at least a supporting one, in the Worldcon coming up in Nippon. Also, the vote, because the voting is very key, and every vote counts. In the last vote, actually, the voting that took place at the Toronto Worldcon, we led the votes every day. We lost that Worldcon bid in the ones that were mailed in, the base of people that so everyone, even the ones that aren't at the convention, that's where the difference was made.
Keith, I want to thank you for coming here and allowing me to interview you.
Thank you, Chris. I was very honored.
You're welcome. As Keith said, it's important to honor our fans. Without them, we wouldn't have these wonderful conventions to attend, nor would we get a chance to meet the creators behind the science fiction and fantasy we love so much. And as I mentioned in an earlier podcast, the next generation of writers and artists often come from the weird and wonderful world of fandom. I would also like to say a few words about Bob Tucker. I don't remember a great deal about Bob from the early years of Ocon, but what I do remember is this. I remember enjoying the conversations I participated in when he was in the consuite, which is where I saw him most. I also remember that Bob was welcoming and inclusive, which was very nice for someone who was totally new to fandom way back then. I do want to remind our listeners that Conestoga 11 will be July 20th through the 22nd, 2007. Our guest of honor will be Laurel K. Hamilton. Artist guest of honor, John Picasso, our Toastmaster, Elizabeth Moon, and our fan guests of honor, Richard and Michelle Zellick, who are heavily involved in Archon, which will host next year's NASFIC, August 2nd through the 5th, 2007, in Collegeville, Illinois. Speaking of Archon, I'd like to welcome the third convention podcast to the Podosphere. It was starting to get a little lonely with just the Conestoga and Balticon podcast. Be sure to check out the Archon Convention Podcast, and I'll provide a link in the show notes. So, until our next Conestoga podcast, thanks for listening. For more information, our web address is www.sftulsa.org, or send an email to conestoga@sftulsa.org. Questions about our podcast may be sent to podcast@sftulsa.org. Please send us an email or put a comment on the website and let us know what you thought of this podcast.